Hello, this is Scott Gillespie, and welcome to the third season of Plants Dig Soil. In this podcast, you will learn how to think critically about regenerative practices as you work to incorporate them into your agricultural, horticultural, and home gardening systems. In early September, I made the case for cover crops to an audience of potato growers from all over Canada. Possibly from all over the world as, like most things today, it was online. I have found that creating presentations helps me to refine my thoughts on a particular subject, and this one was no different. I really had to think through how it makes sense for a farm to use them. At one point, the idea of return on investment, or ROI, came to me. I had heard a segment about it on Real Ag Radio one day this summer, and that must have been why it came to mind as I started applying it to cover crops. I realize that there's really no reason to use them unless the farm expects to get a return on the money spent. As I was thinking further, the return needs to come back to the farm as soon as possible. Cover crops are usually an investment in the following crop year, so it's reasonable to expect that any money spent on them should return within a year. There's no reason to spend money just to have it come back, so there should be a benefit back to you greater than if nothing was done. In my talk to potato growers, I illustrated the concept with fungicide use. Even organic growers will likely have used an organic approved product. The Irish potato famine was caused by a disease called late blight. The disease is still around today and still just as deadly. It can take down a field in a matter of days if the conditions are perfect. After taking down the foliage and the stems, it could move into the soil, infect the tubers, and destroy them as well. On your farm, market garden, or home garden, think about something that you apply each year. Perhaps you could think of a fertilizer, or maybe compost or manure. It could be a particular herbicide, fungicide, or insecticide. It does not matter if you're organic or not. I'm sure there's something you apply each year to your land. Maybe even think of the seeds you plant. How about we use that? Think of planting your cash crop. If you do not plant anything, you will get weeds. You may get something that the other creatures around you can eat, but it's not something you can eat or harvest and sell. If you plant something, you at least have something. You know from experience how many seeds to plant, so think what happens when you plant the proper amount. Now what happens if you plant too much? Too close of spacing for some plants, like carrots, means you do not get the size you want. Overseeding and then thinning can help you make up for some of the seeds not germinating, or pests taking some of them out. However, there's a point when you're spending more than you're getting back. If you could have planted less and achieved the same final plant stand, you spent more than you needed to. Shifting back to cover crops, if you can solve an immediate problem, then you should get payback within the growing season. Holding onto soil and or the nutrients pays back right away. Solving a short-term problem should still pay back more than the money spent. Examples of short-term problems to solve include increasing water infiltration, increasing nutrient availability, and lowering pest pressures. Long-term problems to solve with cover crops can be hard to justify spending money on right now, as it could take decades to see the return. The two main problems to solve are increasing stable organic matter and increasing water holding capacity. The beauty of cover crops is that unlike most inputs you apply to your farm, the benefits from immediate and short-term goals accrue to long-term goals. Before moving on, I want to make sure that you have a link to the presentation that this podcast episode is based on. I had mentioned last month that I'd be sure to put the link to the replay in, and you'll find it in the transcript. The full title is, Are Cover Crops Worth the Work? A Spud Smart Roundtable Webinar and Podcast. You'll be able to find it on spudsmart.com. I'm covering the highlights in this episode, but to dive deeper, I encourage you to check it out. I also mentioned last month that I'd recorded an episode for the Pulse School on realagriculture.com. That episode has now been posted, and the link will be in the transcript for it as well. The full title of it is Targeted Cover Crop Use Could Reduce Soil Erosion. For the remainder of this episode, I'm going to expand on the immediate, short, and long-term benefits of a cover crop. While listening, be thinking return on investment or ROI terms. I often say that holding onto your soil will always pay. While intuitively this makes sense that you do not let your soil blow or flow away, I want to make the case that there's a direct economic cost. A few years ago, while out soil sampling, I saw some soil that had been blown into a ditch. There had been a wind event that had moved some soil from a newly harvested potato field. I probed a bunch of spots in it and put it in one of my bags. I had the lab determine the soil texture, so I had a scientific basis for classifying it. It was basically beach sand, right on the line between a sandy loam and a loamy sand. It was 78% sand, 10% clay, and 12% silt. In southern Alberta, we farm in a semi-arid area near the Rocky Mountains that gets very little rain. Our soils are called brown soils because historically, and I'm talking thousands of years, they do not produce a lot. 2% organic matter is considered to be good in this area. I do not know what the native prairie would have been, but I know that some grassland that had never been farmed and had only been grazed with cattle was 2.8% organic matter when I tested it. This blown beach sand soil was 2.4% organic matter. There was not much nitrogen in it, but that's to be expected as nitrogen gases off or leaches very easily. What was surprising was that the phosphorus was 164 parts per million, or just over 300 pounds per acre for every 6 inches of depth. Phosphorus is typically exceptionally low in our soils without a lot of manure or fertilizer over the years. We have naturally high potassium levels in our soil, but even this was high at 820 parts per million, or over 1,600 pounds per acre. I will not go through the micronutrients, but even all of them were above the critical numbers. Some were even in the moderate to high range. When you hold onto your soil, you hold onto nutrients. We do not tend to be at excess moisture levels, even with all of the irrigation, but if you regularly have water flowing through the profile, you can also lose mobile nutrients, such as nitrogen. To me, this is the best reason to grow a cover crop, holding onto soil and nutrients. With current fertilizer prices, this pays even more now. Holding onto your soil is goal number one. Once you have achieved that, you may want to move on to the next level and make some improvements to it. Three common goals are to increase water infiltration, increase nutrient availability, and lower pest pressures. Water infiltration may be increased within weeks of a cover crop being established, but it's more likely something that will gain over multiple cycles. Water infiltration is not the total amount that the soil can hold. This refers to how fast the water can move through the soil. When you have good infiltration, you can take rainstorms quickly and have less runoff. When irrigating, you can put more water on at a time. If you can grow a legume cover crop and incorporate or leave all of it in place, you have a chance to increase the nitrogen content of your soil. For this to work, it needs to grow long enough to grow significant biomass, and it must have actively producing nodules. Phosphorus cannot be easily mined from the soil, no matter what the celebrity farmers say. Microbial mining of soil particles is a fact. However, the rate that it occurs is at a fraction of what we export in the crop off the land each year. What we can tap into, and I think the no fertilizer added people are actually using, is the legacy phosphorus. Phosphorus fertilizer gets tied up quickly in the soil and is slowly released over the years and decades that follow. If a cover crop does the work to liberate this instead of your cash crop, and its decomposition coincides with your cash crop growth, you may be able to access this before it again gets tied up. If you want to explore this more, I suggest you check out an episode from earlier in the season called Three Pillars Propping Regen Ag. In it, I go deeper into why I think microbial mining is not happening at the rate many claim it is, and why I think legacy phosphorus is what you're actually accessing. There's nothing wrong with using this legacy phosphorus. You just need to understand that it's not a sustainable way, as you'll be mining the soils of nutrients in the long term. Lowering pest pressure is the final of the short-term goals that I think cover crops should be used for. Herbicide-tolerant weeds are a common reason that most farmers in the United States get into cover crops, and it is where that they have the most success. By covering the land with the best species for the job, that crowd out the undesirable species. It's not 100% control, but it may allow them to use the herbicides that they do have more effectively. To get a farmer perspective on this, I suggest you check out two episodes of Fieldwork Podcast, where they talk about the cotton industry and talk to a farmer using cover crops. One of the key takeaways I heard was to use the species that meets your goals. Adam Chappell tried diverse mixes of cover crops, but they did not achieve the goal of suppressing pigweed. Through trial and error, he learned what worked on his farm and what makes him money. He also dives deep into return on investment thinking for all areas of his farm. He has actually let go of land because he can be more profitable on the acres he does have. Bigger is not always better. The links will be in the transcript. Insect and disease suppression is where I get the most excited about the potential of cover crops. Work in the Pacific Northwest of the United States over the last decade by farmers and researchers has shown that green manure crop of mustard ahead of potatoes can decrease disease and increase yield. Specific varieties of mustard must be used. They must grow long enough to get big biomass. They must be chopped and incorporated into the soil within minutes to have their effect. Growing a small crop, not incorporating it, or mixing in other species is not enough for the effect. Treating it like an input and giving it the attention that a cash crop gets pays you back. I'd like to put a caution out here that the research is only in its infancy. A particular cover crop may work in one agricultural region and not work in another. We must test them in our area and the conditions to determine if they are a fit. In the SpudSmart webinar, there was a question at the end about conflicting results on a particular pest. Canadian research showed a particular cover crop species increased the pest, whereas Dutch research showed the same cover crop decreased the pest. It is unclear why this is the case. The researchers are simply reporting what they're seeing. Farmers should be cautious before making big changes on their farms, before the true impacts are known. To review, I have covered the immediate and short-term goals you may be looking at when growing a cover crop. Focus on something that gives a tangible result to your farm right now. Immediate goals such as holding onto your soil and/or nutrients defend your land. Short-term goals such as increasing water infiltration, increasing nutrient availability, and decreasing pest pressure improve your soil. That is where you spend your money, and that is where you see your results. Unlike many things you spend money on for your farm, if you keep up with defending and improving your land, the benefits will accrue over time. These benefits may include increasing organic matter and increasing water holding capacity. These goals are extremely hard to measure because of their long-term timeline. You may counter with the argument that organic matter goes up quickly in no-till and cover crop systems. However, you must dig deeper. Literally. Most studies only look at the top 5 to 15 centimeters, or 2 to 6 inches. When researchers take the entire rooting zone into account, which is 1 to 2 meters or approximately 3 to 6 feet, there's often no net difference. It's hard to see how this can be, but I think part of it is that our time scales are too short. Soils take thousands of years to develop. Perhaps a 2-year or 10-year study is not long enough. I have 2 entire episodes devoted to this with extensive references, so I'd encourage you to check them out. One is from last season, Caution on Carbon Payments. The other is from earlier this season, Carbon in Its Proper Place. Remember to get local advice before acting upon this information. If you do not know who to talk to, get a hold of me and I'll help you to find someone. If you're in my local area and need help, contact me. It is always free to chat. If we get to the point that the scope broadens to consulting work, we can work out a plan that fits your budget. Would you like to keep up with me through a free monthly newsletter? Go to www.plantsdigsoil.com/contact and select the newsletter option. If you've not subscribed to the podcast yet, please make sure you do in your favorite app. If you're a longtime listener, will you consider leaving me a review? This helps others to discover the podcast. If you know of someone that would enjoy this, please make sure to share it with them directly or through your social networks. If you're still listening, you're probably like me and want to know what the catch is. Why am I putting out this information for free? The reason is that I love to learn and I love to share the information. My knowledge has been built up from experience in my own garden, advising clients in my consulting business, and from reading the latest books and articles on agronomy and regenerative agriculture. I have a Bachelor of Science in Agriculture with an agronomy focus and a Master's of Science with a focus on plant science. Beyond my formal education, I have attained and maintained my Certified Crop Advisor designation and am a member in good standing with the Alberta Institute of Agrologists. Nearly everything I talk about is from free resources posted to university and research organization websites. Books that used to be hard to track down are available to buy or borrow for nearly anyone with an e-reader. The information is out there. Sifting through it all is what takes the time. I make my living entirely from consulting. I do not sell products, software, or systems. I strive to be as independent and as unbiased as possible so I can provide the best advice to my clients and help as many people as possible move from conventional to regenerative agriculture.